Cornell University in New York, where he is a fellow in pulmonary and critical care medicine. So he's in exactly the right field to be commenting on this phenomena. He founded the Consciousness Research Group and is chairman of the Horizon Research Foundation. Dr. Parnia is constantly in demand as a speaker, and he's made numerous media appearances. His groundbreaking research was recently featured in the BBC Two and Discovery documentary, The Day I Died. Now, the book he has, this is Dr. Parnia's first book. I've got it right here, simply called, indeed, I'm going to read it, What Happens When We Die. I've perused it already, but I guarantee you, this is one I will read, and I hope you will too. We'll be right back. This clearly in life is the largest question any of us will ever face, ever consider, ever ultimately come to understand. It is the biggest question, and it is simply what we can all attest to our current presence on planet Earth, right? We have consciousness. We understand where we are. We understand the desk or the whatever it is in front of us. It's material. We can touch it, understand it, feel it. We are alive. But once we die, once we physically die, is there anything else? If that is not the biggest question on the planet, it ought to be. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Sam Parnia, welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on the program.
Great to have you. I've been really looking forward to this for a very long time. Certainly, you're in the right field of medicine to be asking the kind of questions you're asking. I'm curious, Doctor, actually, how you came to begin studying all of this. What drove you to study this in the first place?
Well, there were a number of things, really, that came together in my life. The first thing was that while I was training as a medical student, I started dealing with patients who were obviously dying. This was towards the end of my clinical years. And it touched me very much. And in particular, there was one patient that I was looking after one day who I got to know very well. And in fact, I had been on an elective in New York. This is almost 11 years ago now. And this is a gentleman who was, was admitted to the emergency room, I should say. And I met him, I spoke with him, his family, I got to know him very well. I left him, and then about half an hour later, there was a cardiac arrest alert, and I ran to the emergency room, and I noticed that the whole team of doctors were there. They were trying to resuscitate this man. And I stood there, and I watched, and I suddenly realized that this is the same man that I had been speaking to half an hour earlier.
Oh.
And that his heart had now stopped, and that people were trying to get him back to life. And unfortunately, he didn't make it, despite all the efforts that the team made on that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at one point just watching him as he slowly progressed and he died, and thinking to myself, I wonder what's happening to this conscious thinking being that was here with us half an hour ago, whose company I enjoyed so much. I wonder what's left of him.
Yes.
Is he able to watch us? Is he able to hear us? And I'd heard of people who claimed to have near-death experiences, who claimed to be able to watch doctors and nurses working on their bodies from a point above. And I wondered whether he could have been conscious of what we were doing, or had he been completely annihilated.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I didn't know. And I then turned to science. I turned to medicine to see what answers we had found. And I realized that actually very little work had been carried out in this field. And that really was what started my biggest interest in this.
All right. You did mention the paddles. And I'm, very curious. When these paddles are used on patients, Doctor, is there any way to attach a percentage of the time that you're actually able to restart a heart?
Do you mean how often we can get...
How often you're able, if you have somebody right there, how often you're able to restart a heart versus how often you call the time of death?
Well, that depends on a number of different circumstances. For example, how long someone's heart had stopped in the first place, the longer that period becomes, the less likely we are to be able to restart it. In general, if we can have a patient, if we can have people resuscitated back to life and discharged from hospital, say, within 7 days, we'd be expecting about sort of a 20% success rate.
About 20%?
Yes, absolutely. Obviously, you have to appreciate when people have a cardiac arrest, by definition, they've reached the point of death, and
sure.
Most of them, if we don't interfere, all of them would probably die, and therefore we're just trying to do what we can to restart the heart.
Well, that's remarkable. I had no idea what the percentage was, but about 20%, folks. So that's what, about a 1 in 5 chance if your heart stops, I guess, or you. I'm assuming that many, if not most times, there's an underlying condition that won't allow, excuse the word, a restart.
Yes. There obviously could be numerous causes that can lead the heart to stop in the first place. And some of them are associated with a better prognosis. You know, we have a better chance of restarting the heart. For example, if somebody's heart has just a very abnormal electrical activity where it starts to beat very abnormally and then stops because of that,
mm-hmm.
usually if we shock it, by applying a bit of electricity, as you've probably seen with the paddles, then that has a very good success rate. Whereas, for example, if somebody's heart has stopped and they've gone into a flat line for various other medical conditions, and sometimes it's much harder, and they have maybe only a 2 or 5% success rate.
Uh-huh. In your research, is there any way, doctor, to understand how long basic functions continue? Let's say the heart stops right now.
Yes.
Is that person on the table still able to hear anything? Are they able to perceive anything? Do we know anything at all about the process and the length of time involved in the process once the heart stops beating?
Yes, we do. We have quite a lot of information about that. There has been a lot of research carried out in studying the whole process of what happens during a cardiac arrest, which is essentially the same as what happens when we're dying. So in other words, the heart stops beating, the patient stops breathing, and then very quickly after that, because there's a lack of blood flow to the brain, of course the brain then shuts down and it stops functioning as well. Now, there have been lots of studies carried out, both in humans and animals, and what they have indicated is that the brain shuts down in terms of its function in a range of time that varies between about 2 seconds up to about 20 seconds. And the average length of time is about 10 seconds. So in that sort of range of time, the brain then ceases functioning for various obvious reasons. And that's measured by using various apparatus, which measures the electricity going across the brain.
So that once the electrical activity in the brain ceases, that person is dead.
That person has started the process, yes, the process of dying, although I have to point out that, of course, death itself is a process. It's not an instant. It is a process that starts at the moment the heart stops and then continues. Now, in the early stages, it's potentially reversible, which is why we try to resuscitate patients. The longer that process goes on, the less likely we are to get somebody back to life. This is really why we study people at that time. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. What I was going to ask is, what is the longest period of time that you're aware of that a person's heart has been restarted and they have been brought back to life? What is the longest period?
I couldn't tell you exactly how long, but I know certainly over an hour.
Oh, my God.
An hour and 20, that sort of time.
Oh, my gosh.
Although that's very... as I said, the longer it goes, the less likely. But there are cases and case reports of people who have been resuscitated certainly over an hour, approaching over an hour and a half, that sort of thing.
My God. That just doesn't seem possible. I was aware of some cases, for example, where children had fallen into the water and ostensibly drowned, and their body temperature was lowered as a result of that. Would that be the kind of case you're talking about?
Those cases are much more likely, exactly, to be rescued, because of the fact that the temperature had dropped, and therefore their metabolism in the body had slowed down, and therefore there's less damage. Because the thing that causes the most harm is when the blood flow to the brain ceases, then the brain cells start to become damaged through their own chemical activities. They start to, in a sense, poison themselves. And therefore, if you're cold, then all those chemical reactions become slowed down, and therefore the time can become prolonged.
Uh-huh. That still seems absolutely outrageous, an hour. All right, so you began your investigation of people who have had these experiences and have come back. Another question for you, can you make any judgment about the percentage of those who have actually clinically died, doctor, and have had NDEs versus those who do not report NDEs?
Well, there have been reports of people who describe near-death experiences. And the first time that these became sort of prevalent were in the 1970s after Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life. In 1982, there was a Gallup survey carried out here in the United States, and this suggested that about 4 or 5% of the population have had a near-death experience at some point in their lives. But the problem with this definition or this discussion about near-death experiences had always been that it is very difficult from a scientific point of view to define the concept of being near-death. It's a very broad term. You know, what do you mean by near-death? And so what we have done, and that's certainly been the case since in the last few years, and other people have also carried studies in the same way, is to define this at a time when people really are clinically dead. In other words, a cardiac arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at cardiac arrest scenarios, which is essentially the same as clinical death, then we have about 10 to 20% of people who have been shown to have essentially well-structured lucid thought processes with reasoning and memory formation, and they describe typical features of a near-death experience.
10 or 20%?
10 to 20. It depends on the studies that have been carried out. There have been 4 studies carried out now, all published in the last few years in scientific and medical journals.
Mm-hmm. Well, that still certainly represents a large number of people who have had this experience. Now, I have seen various stories on 60 Minutes and other programs where, you know, to get the negative side of the NDE, they usually will have a physician who basically says, nonsense, you know, just absolute nonsense. The brain begins dying from the outside in, and so these people who report the white light are simply reporting what they perceived as their brain began dying from the outside, moving inward. You know, I've heard statements like that. How would you respond to that?
Absolutely. Well, that's a very good point, and it really goes back historically to how near-death experiences had been received by the medical and scientific community. After they were described in 1975 by Raymond Moody, obviously the people who had the experience really claimed to have had, or at least the majority of them claimed to have had, a glimpse of the afterlife. They really believed that they had seen something of the other world. And the scientific reaction to that was that these are probably at best some sort of hallucination due to the fact the brain is shutting down, it's dying.
Right.
And maybe even at worst, people are fabricating these cases. Perhaps people are just making it up for attention.
Hmm.
Now, what's been shown is that actually there have been cases that go back historically many, many years. In fact, the first reference to a near-death experience is said to come from Plato's Republic.
Really?
Yeah, which goes back obviously thousands of years. There's a very interesting painting by Hieronymus Bosch, the famous Dutch painter from the 14th, 15th century, and he's essentially drawn a typical near-death experience with a tunnel with a very bright light at the end of it,
yes,
and people being accompanied by angels going towards that. And that's very interesting because if you think about it, this idea of having that when we die we see a tunnel with a bright light isn't a prevalent Christian or really any other religious view of how we should die. So certainly these go back. Now, in terms of your original question, that's really where that has come from. There had been a number of theories put forward by a number of scientists, psychologists, to try and account for why people have near-death experiences. And the most common theory is that this may be due to some sort of lack of oxygen to the brain, and what that's doing is causing people to have an illusion of seeing a tunnel with a bright light.
Yes.
The problem with this is that although we know that, of course, every experience that we have, including near-death experiences, are mediated by the brain, if we were to simply identify which parts of the brain from, for example, which cells become active that lead to to an experience, this doesn't tell us anything about whether an experience is real or not. By that I mean, if you think about a simple example, if you take a mother who sees their child and they feel love for their child,
mm-hmm.
well, that love is being mediated by certain parts of the brain that become active. So that if we put them into a scanning device, we can see which parts of the brain become active.
Right.
But just by identifying areas of the brain that mediate any experience that we have, and this takes place for every experience that we have, it doesn't tell us anything about whether that love was real or not.
That's certainly a good point.
Do you realize, it doesn't mean that love, for example, is a hallucination. And therefore, although we know that certainly when people are dying, certain parts of their brain become active, and that leads to a near-death experience, that doesn't mean that the experience was either an illusion or a hallucination. We simply cannot comment on whether that is real. It's certainly real for the person who's experienced it, and as any other experience, it's unique for the individual.
Doctor, can you tell me anything about that part of the brain? You said a specific part of the brain in the dying process becomes active. Now, what part of the brain is that, and what is its normal function?
Well, at this point, nobody yet knows which part of the brain mediates near-death experiences. That's what we'd all like to know.
Oh.
But what I was referring to is that in principle, of course, we know that a part of the brain, which we haven't yet discovered, would have become active. And the reason we know that is because certainly if you think about the dying process, what happens is an individual's blood pressure starts to drop. And that causes the body to release certain chemicals and signals which will then start acting on the brain and on the rest of the body, and we start to release very high levels of hormones to keep us alive, such as epinephrine and various steroid hormones.
All natural?
All natural, of course. It's our body's way of trying to keep us alive. It's really a last-ditch effort to try and maintain the blood pressure and to maintain blood getting to the brain.
That's fascinating. I didn't know the body had that capability.
Absolutely. Absolutely. At that time, we released the highest levels ever recorded, over 1,000 times normal levels of these hormones.
Isn't that something? 1,000 times normal?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, yes.
So, okay, we know that, which is fascinating. Are there ethical reasons why we have not been able to have somebody in the right machine, or even multiple somebodies who are in the process of dying, to determine what does occur in the brain, what part of the brain becomes active during that process? Are there ethical reasons why we don't know?
Well, it's actually, there are two separate questions. Obviously, different parts of the brain would become activated.
Doctor, I'm sorry. Hold this for the break. We're at a break point. I truly appreciate the way Dr. Parnia is answering questions. I'm just learning a lot. Doctor, welcome back to the program. So we were talking a little bit about what we don't know, meaning the part of the brain, for example, that is extremely active during the process of death itself. Now, I had asked, are there ethical reasons? I know we can look at the brain with various machines, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yes, we can do.
So are there ethical reasons that we don't?
Well, we're limited in terms of how much we can look at the brain during that time, because if you imagine a cardiac arrest, it's first of all an event that happens very suddenly.
Yes.
It's usually not predicted.
Yes.
And then the main priority, of course, of all the teams are to try and resuscitate the person back to life. And so it is very difficult to sort of start to do very invasive tests on people at that time. The best that we can do is to study this process in people who happen to have had a brain monitor attached to themselves, what we call an EEG device, and then who happen to have a cardiac arrest.
Very rare, but I'm sure it happens. Have we learned anything from that?
What that has demonstrated is that essentially by about 10 seconds, first of all, as soon as the heart stops, the electrical waves in the brain slow down, and by about 10 seconds, we get a flat line on the brain during that time. But beyond that, in terms of identifying specific points in the brain or areas in the brain, in humans it's very difficult to do.
But a flat line, that means everything stopped.
That means exactly that the function of the brain has stopped at that time, which makes sense because there's no blood flowing to the brain, so of course we wouldn't expect the brain to be able to function, just as every other organ stops functioning as well at that time.
Is it possible, Doctor, that what we are calling a flat line is only up to the limit of what we can measure? In other words, I guess I'm asking, could there be electrical impulses that the equipment we have is unable to measure still going on?
It's certainly possible with, obviously, with every apparatus, with every device that we design, they have a certain limit of detection.
Yes, exactly.
And the same thing is obviously true with the measuring brain electrical activity. So certainly we couldn't comment on whether there is some activity within brain cells at a very, so we say, more minute level.
Yes.
That we cannot measure. What we do know, though, however, is that when there is an insult to the brain, and by that I mean any kind of derangement in the normal function of the brain, so for example, if there's a lack of oxygen, if there is a reduction in, say, the blood sugar levels that gets the brain, if there's any kind of head injury or trauma, anything like that, this can be measured through a change in the electricity that the cells generate. And we can certainly measure that with the apparatus that we have currently.
Huh.
What we know, though, is that a cardiac arrest is the biggest insult to the brain, such that actually it causes such a heavy insult that the electrical waves actually go completely flat. In other conditions, they don't go flat. They, you know, they may change to some degree, but they don't normally go flat. This happens in a cardiac arrest. Or if, for example, artificially somebody has had something done to the brain to try and shut it down for any other reason.
All right. You've been so good answering questions that I'm going to jump out in left field for a second and ask you one that I haven't been able to get an answer from others with. And
sure.
It is this. Remember the movie Flatliners?
Yes.
Okay. My question is, if you took a perfectly normal, healthy person and you induced, electrically induced the heart to stop.
Yes.
You gave me a figure of 10 to 20% revival rate in general, somewhere in there. But if you took a perfectly healthy person and stopped their heart and induced an NDE, how much higher would the percentage of success be in restarting their heart?
Well, you probably mean to induce a cardiac arrest.
Yes, sir.
A death experience.
Yes, sir.
Well, this is actually something that takes place very commonly in medical practice. You know, there are a lot of people who have problems with the electricity in the heart, and they have to have certain devices attached to them. They're called an AICD device. It's like a specialized pacemaker.
Right.
And what it does is when the heart has a near-fatal rhythm or an abnormal beat, what it does is it detects that, and then it discharges a small amount of electricity and essentially shocks the heart back to a normal rhythm. So what doctors do, what cardiologists do when they're inserting these, is they will often, in order to test it, they have to actually artificially stop the heart themselves with electricity and then wait to see if this device kicks in and restarts the heart.
One hell of a test.
Yes, absolutely.
Of course. Wow. So then you're telling me that the percentage must be very, very high for a healthy person. If you induce it to stop, then the possibility of restarting it is 70%, 80%, 90%?
No, I mean, in those people, obviously, it's 100% in those people. Nobody would want to go
really?
For a test to have a device inserted if they thought they had a 20% risk of dying.
That's a good point.
But you have to also bear in mind that that's done in a very controlled setting so that, you know, the heart is stopped transiently only for a few seconds, and then that device restarts the heart again. That's not what happens really in a sort of a normal, should we say, a cardiac arrest, when somebody is ill and due to an illness, their heart stops. But when those AICD devices are being inserted, of course, the heart is stopped transiently.
Again, that's incredible. That's amazing. So So the whole premise then of that Flatliners movie, even though fiction, really is, can be supported.
I think the concept of the movie was certainly fascinating, and certainly what they were trying to do was, you know, the idea was supported, because if you stop somebody's heart and then you're looking to see what they're experiencing, and it gives you an idea of what we're all going to experience at the end of our lives when our hearts do stop.
Wow. Okay. Now, you mentioned that there was a history. Of course, Dr. Raymond Moody, I've interviewed many times, and you mentioned that, kind of like Roswell, was the beginning of flying saucer reporting, that the beginning of real reporting on this subject was Dr. Moody's book. But clearly, this would have had to have been going on for all of mankind's existence, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
And there's a lot of evidence of that.
Absolutely, there is, yes. I mean, as I was touching on earlier, one of the criticisms that was put forward after Dr. Moody described these near-death experiences was that, well, why is this only something that's been described since the 1970s?
Exactly.
Of course, if it's really an indication of what happens when people are dying, then it should have been around, as you pointed out, for as long as mankind has been around. And certainly there are many references. If we look in the historical literature, there are many references to near-death experiences. I mentioned that there's a reference in Plato's Republic. There's a very interesting painting which shows one. There's a very interesting article from a British admiral who almost drowned around 1795 off the British coast. And he describes his experience, which is very similar to what we now call a near-death experience. And in fact, the first study, really, of near-death experiences actually took place in 1892. And Albert Heim, a Swiss mountaineer and geologist, who himself had a near-fatal mountaineering accident and had a very interesting experience, then collected the cases of 30 other people and found that they had also had very similar experiences to his own, which we would now call a near-death experience.
All right. So, to be clear, Dr. Moody wrote about the whole thing, the tunnel, people greeting you, all the rest of it. But you're saying in these old documented collected cases, the same rough experience was reported, is that correct, prior to Dr. Moody's book?
Yes, exactly, absolutely.
The tunnel, the light, the whole thing?
Some of them. There's a point, I have to just mention something here, which is that even you can see this in Dr. Moody's book, nobody necessarily has to have all of those features. So somebody won't necessarily see a tunnel alight, you know, say deceased relatives, and then go into a very beautiful heavenly type mm-hmm. of place, all in that same order. They may see two or three of those features. So,
but there was enough in the old studies to identify that, it's the same thing.
Exactly, absolutely. For example,
wow.
The painting by Bosch that I mentioned earlier is fascinating because he's clearly shown a tunnel with a very bright light at the end of it and various, you know, people being going towards that light. So that's really a classical description of a near-death experience that we now talk about.
Are there any NDEs that have gone? I would assume that people go to various stages. In other words, ultimately reaching, I don't know, do we use the word heaven? I guess what I'm asking is, how much of an NDE have we ever had described? How far? Have they actually gone all the way, doctor, to the other side and then come back?
Well, that's a very difficult question for me to answer because it depends on what we mean by the other side.
That's true.
Obviously, if you talk to those who have had the experience, the vast majority of them certainly would tell you that they have seen something of the other side. I have, for example, interviewed others who didn't believe in that. For example, I had a lady who I interviewed who was an atheist, and she did not believe that there is any afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to me that she had had, you know, an experience where she was critically ill, her blood pressure had dropped, and that she had at that point separated from her body, and she was watching everything below, and she'd seen a tunnel and a light. But when she came back, she was almost bemused by the whole thing because she said, well, I didn't believe in anything, so I don't know why I had an experience. Almost say, well, it shouldn't be happening to me. she still had an experience, but her interpretation of it was that it can't be real because she didn't believe in anything.
Huh.
The majority of people who have the experience, however, come back and they really believe that they had a glimpse of the afterlife.
And to what degree is this determined by a person's religious or spiritual faith?
People of all backgrounds can have near-death and do have near-death experiences. That isn't related to their personal, cultural, or religious beliefs. What effect religion or culture does have on the experience is in the interpretation of the experience. So, for example, if you look, near-death experiences have been described from all over the world, but say if a Hindu and a Christian have a near-death experience and they're both seeing a being of light, the Hindu may come back and describe having met one of the Hindu gods, say, for example, Krishna.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Christian would come back and describe it in Christian terminology and say, well, I met Jesus. And that's really the difference. And that's also very interesting when you look at children's near-death experiences.
Oh?
They have very similar features to adults, but their description is often limited by their own understanding and their own vocabulary and terminology that they can use.
Of the world, yes.
So the interpretation of the experience depends on the individual's background. But the features, by and large, are the same.
That's the important part. The features are the same. The interpretation may be different, but the features are the same. That is what's so fascinating about this.
Absolutely. I think it's really fascinating, especially when you look at children, because many of them are too young to have any concept of death or an afterlife. You know, I've interviewed children who've had near-death experiences when they weren't even 3 years old yet. And so it's very difficult to argue that they, you know, had seen what they, for example, believed they were going to see. Well, they don't really know what death is, let alone what they should experience if they were to have an afterlife.
Doctor, what are the chances that the human brain does have a very specific way that it dies, as that doctor's, you know, who stood up and said, look, it dies from the outside, moving inward, and so this light that we're seeing is the very center of the brain and all that's left, and so that's all we're seeing, and it doesn't go any further than that.
Well, this is actually something I wanted to come back to, and this is a good chance for me to explain this a little bit further. You see, the theories that have been put forward can only account for certain aspects of a near-death experience. For example, it's been proposed that when people feel very peaceful, mm-hmm. it's due to the fact that there's a sudden release of endorphins into the bloodstream when the brain is shutting down, or the fact that they see a light with a tunnel may be due to activity of brain cells in the back of the brain where vision is usually mediated. Now, I think it's definitely true that when we die, there are certain changes within the brain that take place, but I have to just point out again that identifying those changes, although we don't yet know exactly where they are, undoubtedly there are centers in the brain that become activated, won't ever tell us whether an experience is real or not.
That's right.
Because the majority of the features are personal. For example, somebody says they felt peaceful, they saw a tunnel, they saw light, they saw maybe their deceased father or their deceased mother. Those are personal to the individual. We could never say it happened or it didn't happen. However, the most interesting aspect are those people who come back and describe separating from the body and watching events from a point above at the ceiling.
Yes.
And that's interesting because they actually come back and tell us very specific things that we did. And I've had a number of medical doctors, very senior medical doctors, who've had patients come back and describe in specific details what they had done during a cardiac arrest.
How does a doctor react when a patient it tells them?
Completely bemused. Completely bemused. I had one
bemused.
Of my colleagues who actually said to me, pulled me aside one day and said, look, I haven't told anybody this because it's just completely shaken me and I cannot explain it and I've just decided not to think about it anymore. And he described this whole scenario of how he has been involved in the resuscitation of a 30-year-old man who had a flat line on his heart monitor, and who they had thought had died, and they had stopped resuscitation.
Uh-huh.
And eventually managed to get him back, and it was a very long story. But this gentleman came back a week later from the intensive care unit, met this colleague of mine, and told him in exact detail what he had done, what he had said during this event. And if I just want to sort of point this fact out, that these are very interesting because we can't simply write these off as being hallucinations or illusions, because people are coming back and describing very specific details
of what was going
on. Verified. Exactly.
Is there any medical explanation for a person's being able to do that? Is there any medical explanation?
Well, that's what we're trying to understand right now, and that's very difficult to explain because our current views, and these are only views I must point out, about the relationship between our mind or consciousness, and by that I mean everything that makes us unique as individuals, our sense of self-awareness, our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions.
Right.
We currently, our neurobiological views are that these are generated by the brain. Although I have to point out that nobody has yet been able to put forward a mechanism by which brain cells could generate thoughts. Nobody knows how that comes to be. And what the occurrence of these experiences, these near-death experiences during cardiac arrest does, is it somewhat challenges that view, because we have a group of people who have essentially no brain activity, no electrical activity of the brain, yet nevertheless they're able to come back and have very lucid consciousness, have thought processes, and describe what happened.
So there really is no medical explanation for how they're able to do this, and I can understand that a physician probably would say, you know what, I'm not going to think about this anymore, because the implications are simply too great.
Absolutely.
It challenges everything I believe, and therefore I'm going to put it up on the shelf and not think about it.
Absolutely.
That's
the easy way out.
I guess it is the easy way out. I remember, going back to 60 Minutes, they did have an operating room in which they put a number up on some high point in the operating room for exactly the reason you're talking about, because so many people had been coming back and explaining what had been happening to them. So when we get back from this break...